Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, March 2nd, 2004. Today's session is entitled Infectious Diseases, presented by Dr. Greg Fried. This is number FRG 2004-01. Let's listen in.
Welcome everybody. Let's open this forum on infectious disease with a word of prayer. Creator God, your ways are too wonderful and too terrible for us to know. We are filled with awe. We pray for the wisdom to move reverently through all you have created. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Without rival, during the time humans have walked the earth, the most likely cause of death has been infection. Even during famines, most people succumb to infections before they can literally starve to death. It's only since the mid-20th century in the affluent nations of the world that this seemingly eternal fire has been slightly suppressed. But what about war, you ask me? Well, during the American Civil War, three times as many people died of cholera or diphtheria as were felled by force. Those who were wounded most likely died of gangrene, which is an infection, whose ceaseless work was only slightly slowed by the art of amputation. After the First World War, more people died of influenza than had died during the war to end all wars. Thousands of the indigenous people of the Western Hemisphere died of imported infections for every one who was killed by the violence of the invading Europeans. It's estimated that one-fourth of all Europeans died during the bubonic plague. But our Puritan forefathers were remiss in not telling us that even more than that died of syphilis. Even today, most of us know very little about the things that kill most humans: malaria, schistosomiasis, cholera, rotavirus. So I thought it would be worth a little time to talk about infections, those that assail us in ways that are both great and small. Because in my experience, people are quite ignorant of the ways of germs. I will point out the irony in my giving this talk. Microbiology was the only subject that I did badly in medical school. But undaunted, I'm going to push on. I'm sorry for those of you who are visual learners. I tried to make some visual helps for this talk, and they all look like stupid cartoon germs. So I gave it up. And you're just going to have to listen to it. This, however, is a bonus for those who are listening to the recorded version of this. They're not missing any cute diagrams. The history of how we came to discover that germs ruled our lives is a very interesting one. And there are numerous historical stories about various aspects of our discovery of infectious disease. I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave a lot of that alone. Darren and I, for example, at dinner time were talking about yellow fever in the Panama Canal and the huge impact that infectious diseases have on the ways of men. So if you're interested in those things, there's lots of fascinating stories out there. One of the things that you find out when you delve into the history of infections and infectious disease is like my little quip about Europeans dying of plague. In fact, a lot of what history has told us is often erroneous, either based on the ignorance of the times or based on someone's redaction of what they thought should and shouldn't be reported about. I'm going to focus more tonight on our current thoughts on the subject, and in true America-centric fashion, I'm mostly going to talk about those infections, both mild and serious, which affect us. Although my strongest subject in infectious disease was the study of parasitology, I'm largely going to avoid that because it isn't all that important to us. The most ubiquitous, simplest, and earliest life form on the planet are the bacteria. These are the smallest biological units that qualify as living organisms. They are capable of independent existence and reproduction. They are everywhere. And although they frequently kill us, we cannot live without them. The overwhelming majority of bacteria on the planet are, however, quite harmless to us. And we're therefore going to ignore them, just as we do all day every day. Examples of bacteria that you might recognize are staph, which is the nickname for Staphylococcus aureus, strep, which is the nickname for Streptococcus pyogenes, E. coli, which is the nickname for Escherichia coli. Bacteria normally and helpfully live in our noses, in our mouths, in our intestines and vaginas, and of course on your skin. They never, however, normally live in your kidneys, your bladder, your sinuses, your middle ears, your lungs, and so on. Unfortunately, some people's kidneys or sinuses or lungs do become permanently colonized with bacteria, and this is a cause of ill health. Examples of some diseases that are caused by bacteria are, and I'm going to list some famous ones, tuberculosis, which is caused by a bacteria called Mycobacteria tuberculi. Cholera, which is caused by Vibrio cholera. Plague, which is caused by Yersinia pestis, that's a good name. Typhoid fever, caused by Salmonella typhi. Syphilis, Treponema pallidum, gonorrhea, Neisseria gonorrhea. Tetanus, botulism and gangrene, all caused by different kinds of Clostridia. Necrotizing fasciitis, caused by so-called flesh-eating bacteria, is usually caused by a particularly virulent form of strep. Whooping cough, caused by Bordetella pertussis, and so on and so on and so on. Biblically, perhaps leprosy is well known, and that's also caused by a mycobacterium, a similar germ to the thing that causes tuberculosis. There are many bacterial infections that can be caused by a number of different bacteria, such as pneumonia, for example, can be caused by a dozen different kinds of bacteria. So having pneumonia doesn't explain what the specific organism is that's causing the problem. Kidney infections, probably three or four prominent different kinds of bacteria that can cause kidney infections. Subacute bacterial endocarditis can be caused by different germs, including the friendly ones that live in your mouth. Meningitis can be caused by a variety of different bacteria. Dysentery, same thing. Cellulitis, infection of the soft tissues under your skin, abscesses. So these are non-specific types of infection that may have a number of different bacterial causes. Bacteria can cause disease by different mechanisms. In some cases, the bacteria actually kill the host cells and then feed on the dead debris. This would be the case with so-called flesh-eating bacteria. Or the bacteria can release poisons that travel throughout the body and cause widespread damage or death. Botulism is a classic example there, where just a few of these bacteria can release enough of their toxin into your bloodstream to kill you. Or they can cause your own immune system to turn against you. That's what happens in rheumatic fever. Rheumatic fever is caused by a strep infection, where your own immune system then creates most of the damage to your body. So the bacteria can actually start your own system against you. Bacteria can cause localized diseases, such as a boil, for example, which is a localized infection, or widespread disease, where the bacteria go everywhere in your body, which is what causes septic shock. Sepsis is a term used medically to describe what happens when bacteria gain access to the bloodstream and therefore can go everywhere. We consider that bad. That's a bad. Although your immune system can take care of most bacterial invasions, we've done something and gone a step further. We've developed antibiotics, which are designed to kill bacteria and then to eradicate the infection artificially. Plague, for example, that wiped out a quarter of Europe, can easily be treated with tetracycline. Here's how antibiotics work, which is a mystery to most people. Bacteria, you've seen cartoon diagrams of bacteria. They look like a circle and they have little hairs sticking out of them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they have a face on them. Yeah, Pac-Man, is that?
Those little scrubbing bubbles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, you get the idea. They're little organisms that are self-contained. What antibiotics do is they interfere with a bacteria. Well, there are several. I'm going to list four ways. So one way is they keep the bacteria from forming a cell wall. Bacteria are immensely successful evolutionarily because they have what's called a cell wall. They're able to stand huge changes in temperature and in osmotic gradient and exposure to certain chemicals because they have a tough protein and phospholipid-containing cell wall, a fortress, if you will. So, if we can devise an antibiotic that makes the bacteria unable to make a cell wall, it's vulnerable to osmotic gradients, chemicals, and your immune system. So that's one way antibiotics work. Some of them work by keeping the bacteria from metabolizing. It can't produce any energy and therefore dies. Some antibiotics interfere with bacteria's ability to reproduce. In other words, if four bacteria get in and none of them can replicate, they can't do much damage. So by blocking their ability to synthesize DNA, you block them from reproducing, and then your immune system can clean up the rest. And four, bacteria have to make new proteins to make new bacteria. And so some antibiotics interfere with that process. Well, gee, it sounds like we kind of have it covered, doesn't it? No, we don't. Each antibiotic, in order for it to be effective, has to be able to do its magic on the bacteria and not on your cells. If it keeps your cells from reproducing, or if it keeps your cells from replicating its DNA or synthesizing protein or metabolizing, then it kills you too. Some of the early antibiotics that were developed proved to be very toxic to certain things, your kidneys or your ears and so forth. And so what we've tried to do is refine that to take advantage of the difference between your own cells and the bacteria.
Would that be an example like alcohol?
Alcohol isn't an antibiotic. Okay, alcohol is an antiseptic, and alcohol kills cells because it lyses the cell wall of bacteria, lysing it, opening it, and killing the contents. But it does the same thing to your cells too. Yeah. So that antiseptic is nonspecific. Hydrogen peroxide oxidizes bacteria, kills them by causing lysis of their cell wall by attaching oxygen, which some cases we're hearing you probably does. And it does that to a lesser extent to your own cells, so it's more toxic to the bacteria than to you, but it's still somewhat toxic to you. So there's a difference between antibiotics and antiseptics. And there's also a difference between antibacterials. You'll notice a lot of soaps are antibacterial, which means that they may be using an antibiotic to kill germs or an antiseptic, and they can call it that without being specific. Now, many of you know that some bacteria have evolved resistance to antibiotics. This is a frightening development. In some cases, it's led to the development of newer replacements to the antibiotics that have now been developed resistance to. In all cases, it leads to the possibility that there would be widespread disease resurgence. And perhaps most frightening is it leads to the unbelievable power in the hands of relatively few people who run pharmaceutical companies. Here's an example of the most common form of bacterial resistance. And it's a good example of evolution, which is one of the reasons that evolution is so self-evident to me, and for some reason not to everyone. All of the penicillins and cephalosporins, which make up the largest class of antibiotics that we have one common chemical feature, and that common chemical feature is why they're all lumped into the same class. They have a chemical ring on them that's called a beta-lactam ring. And there are diagrams of molecules, and I could have brought one of those, but those always just confused me, so I didn't. But take my word for it, the molecules of all of the different penicillins and cephalosporins have this unique feature, and it is the beta-lactam ring that attaches to the cell wall of the bacteria, which is responsible for the demise of the bacteria. Probably through random mutation or random chance, a bacteria occurred which produced an enzyme which we will call beta-lactamase. Enzymes are chemicals that are able to break down proteins. Okay? So there are enzymes all throughout your body, and certainly bacteria produce enzymes as well that help them digest food and so forth. But this particular enzyme, beta-lactamase, cleaves that beta-lactam ring on the penicillin molecule and makes it not a penicillin anymore. It doesn't work, won't attach to the bacterial cell wall anymore. Okay? Now, in the presence of these antibiotics, the bacteria which produce this beta-lactamase are selected, sort of like the rich under GW. So they prosper. You can therefore take an antibiotic such as Ceftin for your sinus infection, which is caused by a germ called Haemophilus influenza, and you can prevail over that Haemophilus bacteria and get rid of the sinus infection. But at the same time, you have killed the staphylococcus on your own skin that are sensitive to beta-lactams, while you have not killed the staphylococcus on your skin that produce beta-lactamase. So now your skin becomes preferentially populated with these beta-lactamase producing staphylococci. And next time you get a burn or you scrape your knee, you might have an infection that's not treated with cephalosporin antibiotics. This is an oversimplification. And there are many simultaneous and often much more complex interactions going on at the same time. But it still serves as a perfectly good example of what's going on. The high school students often remind me of something which I need reminding of from time to time, and that's that you can't simply change one aspect of the web of life. Everything is interconnected. So, should you take antibiotics or should you use them? Well, this is a complex question, and there's no simple answer. But if the person that recommends that you take antibiotics cannot answer the question of whether you should take them for that particular infection, then you probably shouldn't. As with everything in medicine, if the benefit does not justify the risk, then you probably shouldn't accept the treatment. If there are specific cases of when you should and shouldn't take antibiotics that you'd like to discuss, I'm going to roll that over into the discussion part of this, and we'll press on right now. But I'd be happy to entertain some of those questions if you'd like to ask them. Or if you'd like to ask me privately later, that's fine too. We have, for the past 50 years, had a love affair with antibiotics. Antibiotics were successfully used to treat and even to eradicate many diseases. They allowed people to have surgery more safely. They allow people to survive artificial suppression of their immune system, which is what happens when you have chemotherapy. They've been a wonderful thing. Because they were used for so many things that weren't caused by bacterial infections, the lay public believed that antibiotics had powers way beyond what they really had. Further, we saw the good that they had brought to our lives, but we thought of it as being limitless. We took antibiotics at the slightest provocation, and worse, we tolerated antibiotics being put into our food supply. These are bad practices. Why are they bad practices? Because you will be populated with bacteria that are resistant to those antibiotics. So if the chicken that you eat is full of penicillin, then the streptococcus that you have in your mouth is going to be resistant to penicillin. If you get a gum abscess or tonsillitis, it might not be treatable. All drugs have side effects, and so let's talk about the side effects of antibiotics. All drugs have what we would consider to be their desired effect, and they have other effects as well. If these other effects are noticeable or undesirable, then we call those side effects. Antibiotics tend to cause a number of side effects, some of which are quite serious and even deadly. Since antibiotics kill bacteria, they can, just like in war, kill the civilians. So, in my opening statement, I said bacteria can kill us, but by the same token, we can't live without them. The bacteria that live in your gut are responsible for breaking things down into the nutrients that you can use to keep you healthy. The bacteria in your gut produce all your vitamin K. You can't take vitamin K. You have to have it made for you by the bacteria that live in your gut, and so on. It's a healthy relationship. But if we kill all those bacteria, we've messed up that relationship. Now, when we do that, that can cause diarrhea, which is inconvenient, or it can cause worse. It can cause a form of colitis where you lose the lining of your colon. Pseudomembranous colitis, it's called. If they kill the bacteria in your vagina, assuming you have one, then the yeast that normally live there have a population explosion. And this causes misery that I don't need to explain to anyone who's had a yeast infection. Once again, not a serious problem, but certainly an annoying one. Some antibiotics cause a lot more serious problems. They can cause liver problems or kidney problems, including kidney failure. They can cause deafness. They can cause visual damage. These are important things. Now, fortunately, they don't usually cause these things, but every time you take a medicine like this, even though it's a long shot, you are taking the chance that you're going to be that one person whose liver is affected by taking this drug. Allergies are also caused by antibiotics. Antibiotics are protein molecules, of course, and as such, they can be caused by allergic reactions. In the worst cases, these reactions can be so severe that they can cause shock and death. So, once again, you might be taking an antibiotic for a trivial reason and end up with a life-threatening problem. So what about the future? Well, I think we all had a taste of the potential problems when some malevolent person started mailing anthrax to people. Although anthrax is treatable with amoxicillin, which costs about 10 cents a dose, and it's also treatable with tetracycline, which costs about 10 cents a dose, the United States government bought 150 million doses of an antibiotic called ciprofloxacin, which cost $1.60 a dose. Do the math. Nursing homes have become full of people who have a bacteria called Pseudomonas, and another bacteria called Enterococcus. These are both common bacteria. But they have now been colonized in their guts and in their urinary tracts with these germs which are resistant to all known antibiotics. Now sometimes that results in the death of the host. In other words, they get a kidney infection with Pseudomonas that's resistant to everything and they simply die. Sometimes, however, they're colonized with these bacteria. But they don't die of this. So they become a sort of host or hostile for these germs, which are dangerous to all of us. Most healthcare workers, no, not most, about a third of healthcare workers have staphylococcus on our skin that's resistant to methicillin. And that means that it would be very difficult to treat infections caused by this kind of staph. So if you're in a hospital having your hip replaced, and you get methicillin-resistant staph infecting your new hip prosthesis, that becomes a very difficult problem to treat. Like so many other issues of the environment, it'll be interesting to see if we try to fight our way out of this or whether we take a more passive approach. It is conceivable that in my lifetime there will be epidemics of previously treatable bacteria such as pneumococcus that'll kill the have-nots of the world by the tens of millions. Okay, that's it for bacteria. Now we're going to talk about viruses. And many people confuse the two. Okay, so I'll try to describe what viruses are. The most common cause of infection in human beings are the little pieces of genetic code that are called viruses. A virus is not considered a living organism and is not the most primitive form of life evolutionarily. Viruses became simpler biotic pieces of chemistry subsequent to the evolution of higher life. A virus is not considered a living organism because it's incapable of independent existence and it can't reproduce itself. It needs the machinery of other living cells in order to replicate. Now this is confusing because a virus is oftentimes considered alive, and it's often considered that it can be killed. And so using those words implies that it is in fact alive. I had an interesting conversation with Kyle and Casey when they're sitting out having taking in the sun and having chemistry class one day about this distinction about whether we call viruses living things or not. And ultimately we decided it was relevant. Viruses loom large in our lives because most of us will experience at least a moderate amount of misery and moderate inconvenience because of viruses. We are constantly assailed by viruses, some of which are immediately destroyed by our own immune system, and some of which cause such minor symptoms that it basically goes unnoticed. But anywhere from about once up to maybe as much as 10 times a year, a virus will cause some recognizable illness in us. Obviously, the 10 times a year is in the toddler, where that's basically normal to have 10 viral infections a year. The way that a virus can make you sick is also variable. But we're going to take the example of a common cold, where this virus can enter your respiratory tract on the fomites of an already infected person. These minute spaceships of spit or snot land on your nasal mucosa, and their viral passengers disembark. Your immune cells, which are called phagocytes, meaning eating cells, they're standing by in your own snot, and they're ready to chomp up these little bits of foreign debris when they show up. But a few of these viruses, relatively speaking, will find their way inside respiratory epithelial cells, the ones that line your nose. Even though your nose has its own defense system of A, snot, B, these little tiny hairs that are keep pushing everything out, they can still enter some of the respiratory epithelial cells. They quickly break into the nucleus of the cell and they hijack the protein synthesis mechanism, or they hijack the DNA itself. And sort of like an office interloper, they start using the copying machine until it runs out of paper. Now, when it runs out of paper, the cell itself dies. But by that time, it's made 100 copies of itself. So when that cell dies and opens up, bingo, here's 100 of these viruses where there was one before. And they then go to work on the neighboring cells, and so on, and so on, and so on. At some critical point, usually a couple of days after the first spaceship landed, there will be enough of these viruses that have gained access to your cells that some of them will get into your circulation, and they'll go all over your body. At this point, you start to sneeze, your nose runs, your eyes water, your head hurts, maybe have a scratchy throat or a sore throat, maybe your muscles kind of hurt, sore. So this virus has made effects all over your body. Dying cells from various parts of your body will release chemicals, mayday chemicals, that try to get reinforcements from your immune system. And some of these chemicals make you have a fever, and some of them make you so tired that you're forced to rest. Some of them make you thirsty, so you'll drink a lot of fluid, and so on and so forth. Over the next several days, your immune system will employ a wide arsenal of weapons and will find and neutralize most of these interlopers, and it will eradicate the infection. Because of the inflammatory response that you raise during this war against these viruses, you'll keep coughing and blowing your nose for several more days, maybe even for a week or more, after you've actually quashed the invasion. So your own immune response, your own efforts to defeat this, are a lot of what make you feel bad. Pardon, seems fair. I could make up a similar scenario for an unbelievable number of viral infections, but the basic plot is the same. Virus gets in, goes to its target organ, does its makeup. Examples of viral infections are very diverse, but they include, under the name again, some famous ones: measles, mumps, chickenpox, smallpox, herpes simplex, the well-known Holden-Norwalk virus, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, warts. Common warts are caused by viruses. West Nile virus, a virus in the news. And, of course, the virus that I kept trying to make famous last fall, the influenza virus. For many of these viruses, our body is not only able to eradicate them, but it's able to develop lasting immunity to them, so that once you have had this infection, you can't be reinfected. However, some of these viruses are never eradicated by the host, and they remain inside cells where they can, A, suddenly become active again, like herpes simplex can recur over and over again, or herpes zoster, which is what causes shingles, can recur 80 years after the original infection, which caused chickenpox. Or B, they can continue to cause infection, and in many cases, ultimately cause the death of the victim years after the initial infection. That's what happens with hepatitis C, for example, a smoldering infection that leads to the death of the victim sometimes a decade or more later. Some cause overwhelming infection and rapid death, such as hantavirus or Ebola. Now, I know that many of you probably know more about the most dreaded viral infection of our time, HIV, than I do. But some of you don't, so I'm going to give a brief discussion of why we haven't overcome it yet. The human immunodeficiency virus enters the bloodstream of its victim in what I assume is a familiar avenue. In other words, I think most of you all understand that I'm going to presuppose the knowledge of how the HIV virus gets inside us. It is a very fragile virus, and it can't cause infection if you eat the virus, or if you touch it, or if you inhale it. It can't gain access to our circulation that way. So the infectiousness of HIV is very low, unlike, say, a cold, for example. Even if it does get in your bloodstream, the infectiousness of the HIV virus is very weak compared to something like hepatitis B. Hepatitis B is probably 1,000 times more contagious and infectious than human immunodeficiency virus. Nonetheless, once it gets into your white blood, into your bloodstream, through sex, IV drug use, transfusions, organ donations, and so forth, It specifically looks for and enters white blood cells. Now, your immune system has a bunch of different kinds of white blood cells, and they perform different functions. One of these cells is called the T lymphocyte, and it's responsible for learning foreign proteins and memorizing them. So it learns about various viruses and recognizes them. Once it recognizes them, it can direct other immune cells to find them, destroy them, and these T lymphocytes also clone themselves so that the memory of this virus can be passed on through the rest of your life. That's why, after you've had measles, you don't ever get it again. These T lymphocytes reproduce themselves throughout your whole life, so they remember that measles virus and they won't ever let it happen again. Well, the human immunodeficiency virus has a propensity for these very T cells, and it destroys them, so the victim can't get rid of the infection. And it, in fact, becomes incompetent at dealing with lots of other kinds of infections, too. Without a working immune system, of course, the victim ultimately dies, which is why the disease, particularly untreated, is always fatal. If it makes your immune system fail, you can't live without that. Now, why haven't we been able to make a vaccine for it? Well, I don't know, because my notes are messed up. But I'll make up something. The thing that makes vaccines work is we introduce a protein into our system by a vaccine that our T cells recognize, learn, and develop immunity to. Well, obviously, we can't develop a vaccine to something that destroys T cells so that they can't remember anything. So this has been a so far insurmountable problem. There's a lot of hope on the horizon about vaccines, but they obviously have not been as easy to develop as other types of vaccines. Let's talk a little bit about antiviral drugs. The majority of these drugs have been developed specifically to combat HIV. Before they were used for HIV, there were only a couple of antiviral drugs. And here's how they work. They interfere with some aspect of a virus replicating itself or manufacturing proteins. Well, that sounds like just what you told us about antibiotics. They make them so they can't reproduce themselves, or they make it so they can't replicate proteins. So I suppose in a way that's partly accurate. Frequently, they have to be used in concert with other antiviral drugs to be effective, which is why people, for example, with AIDS may be on 4 or 5 different antiviral drugs. With the exceptions of the drugs that have been used to treat herpes virus and flu viruses, antiviral drugs are very expensive. An AIDS patient may take between $20,000 and $50,000 worth of medicines a year. I don't need to explain this to this audience, the social justice implications of this. Antiviral drugs have been very difficult to develop. And one of the reasons that they're so expensive is because they're very research intensive. Unlike antibiotics, where antibiotics can take advantage of the difference between bacterial cells and human cells, the difference isn't a clear line with these non-cellular items called viruses. They are simply like rogue pieces of genetic material. And so, antiviral drugs also tend to be much more toxic. Once again, one of those cases where the treatment may be worse than okay, well, that's viruses. There are other things that cause infection. Funguses cause infection, like athlete's foot and ringworm and yeast infections. However, we're going to pass on this in the interest of time, and also because I hold out some slim hope that this forum
may yet be interesting.
So let's talk about protozoans. Most of you know what protozoans are because that's what amoeba are. In high school biology, you looked in the microscope and you saw amoeba, which were these bizarre one-celled animals that could change shape. Well, there are lots of different kinds of protozoans besides amoeba. A protozoan is a single-celled animal. Well, how does that differ from a bacteria, which is just one cell? I don't know. I can't tell you. I don't want to hear it. The protozoans have things that define them as animals, like they have mitochondria and ribosomes. Does anybody else remember why they're animals and bacteria aren't? Well, obviously it's not terribly important.
None of us know.
Now, protozoans can cause human infections, and the most serious of these is malaria. Malaria is actually one of the most common causes of death in the world. Malaria is caused by the obligate parasite called Plasmodium, and it's unfortunately becoming increasingly difficult to treat because resistance to many antimicrobials has developed by Plasmodium. AIDS is a horrendous pandemic in the sub-Saharan Africa, but more people die of malaria than of AIDS. Locally, our famous protozoan is Giardia lamblia. It's ubiquitous in the surface waters of the Cascades. In fact, Giardia, since 1976, when it showed up in Vail, Colorado, has basically contaminated all of the surface waters of North America. It's an obligate parasite, which means it has to complete its life cycle in a host. That host can be us, or that host can be a variety of other mammals. It's very hardy. It can live free in water for extended periods of time, or worse, it can form cysts, which are inactive parasites encased in a sort of micro shell, in which case it can stand freezing and thawing and drying out, and so it can be very tough that way. The reason that some people get sick from drinking untreated water and others don't has to do with your own immunity. As many of you know, from living here perhaps, or from other experiences, if five people drink the same untreated water, two or three of them get Giardia, and the others don't get sick. Giardiasis is what the disease of being infected with Giardia is called. And any of you that have had it know that it can cause a number of different symptoms, including fever, generalized illness where you ache all over and you throw up a lot. But it's most famous for causing diarrhea. And the diarrhea caused by Giardia can go on and on for weeks. It's not like the Norwalk virus where you're sick for 8 hours. Giardia is hosted by other animals as well, most famously by the beaver. And so many people think, well, there aren't any beavers around here, so the water must be okay to drink. This was a common idea in Wyoming. If you just went higher than the beavers went, you know, in other words, if you're above tree line, you're okay. But there are other rodents that carry Giardia too, pika, marmot. Pretty high to go higher than pikas go, isn't it? So finding uncontaminated surface water around here is very difficult. People ask me, well, if it's literally dripping off the glacier, is that safe? And my answer is, I always treat all of my water. Okay, well, that's all I have in prepared talk. And yeah, I think I have. So, does anybody have any questions, comments, or discussion? Zach?
Is Giardia in moving water, or is it just in steady water?
Yeah, moving water. It's another thing people believe that, gee, this water is so clear and it's just rushing and mean, you know, that we're just so close to the glacier where it melted from, it must be okay. But just listen. You can hear those pikas. Yeah. So, yeah. And it can also be in places, these cysts, when the water was higher and then it receded, you know, so the cysts can be on like damp areas or even dry areas where the water had previously covered. Stories of people being infected with Giardia, and I've heard lots of them, are sometimes quite unbelievable. People talk about, you know, they're fly fishing and they just bite, you know, they bite the end off after they tie their tippet on or something and they get Giardia. I don't know if that's true or not. A common cause for people here who are quite careful otherwise is that they wash their dishes in stream water or whatever, untreated water, and then they eat their next meal out of that dish and get Giardia. So, pretty infectious. The best way to treat it, is this Giardia questions, or should I keep on with Giardia?
No.
The best way to treat it is to filter your water. Most commercially available and functioning water filters will easily filter out protozoans. My own advice is that when I'm in the backcountry, I filter all my water and then I also treat it with bleach because that kills the viruses.
Why are human immune systems so different?
Well, there's been a lot of study about that, and I haven't read the latest, but you know, several years ago, what they were focusing on is the difference in how much IgA people have. IgA is a kind of immune globulin that's produced by the cells in your gut. And people who have high levels of that they ingest the Giardia, but it never makes them sick. And people who have low levels of that tend to get sick. And the tendency for that is inherited. So a lot of people will say, well, my family's lived in these woods for 30 years and none of us have ever got sick. Well, there is actually a reason for that. It's not because their water isn't contaminated. It's because they just don't get it. And you've known people. Some people that, I always drink the water, it's fine.
Yeah.
Well, for example, yeah. Now, that's not a good practice, because...
But I'm not going to change it, because it hasn't hurt me.
Yeah. But there are other things in the water besides Giardia.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of other things. So, the fact that you don't get Giardia doesn't mean it's okay to drink untreated water.
But what do people do before the REI pumps and all that came out?
Well, Giardia... was introduced into this country by some Russian tourists in 1976.
So, Russians.
Yeah, part of the Cold War. Right. So there wasn't an issue. And of course, I grew up drinking surface water also and not getting sick.
So
things are different than they used to be in that there are a lot more people in the backcountry than there were in the past. And they're from a lot wider areas. Used to be that if there were people in the backcountry, chances were they were people from that area that were in the backcountry. Now somebody comes from Virginia to be in our backcountry, or Japan. Yeah. So it is worse than it used to be. And of course, it used to be bad too. People died from drinking untreated water. They got cholera and died.
The old idea that if the water was running, not to go with the criteria was, but running water was going to be okay, where standing water was not going to be okay.
I don't know what the explanation
was. Giardia? Well, I don't know.
That's what we thought when we used to go backpacking years ago.
I thought it had to do with oxygenation. Like,
the same thing that I learned too, and I don't know that, I don't know whether that was just wrong or whether that was actually, there was some science behind it.
It is just wrong.
But it's wrong.
Great, because they just sink, right? The cysts just sink. They don't swim.
Well, there's both cysts and tropes. There's the active form of the Giardia and the cysts. And so ingestion of either one is bad news.
So when we go to the
the boundary waters, and we're in a lake, at a, you know, we usually go out to the middle of the lake and get
Sonia's,
water.
Sonia's family.
Right, and we never treat it when
right.
we're there.
Yeah, and when I was in the boundary waters in the early 70s, we never treated the water. And when I was in the boundary waters last summer, I did treat
you
the
did.
Water.
So you would say just still treat it.
You know, a lot of those places just have, you know, like you get a cabin up there and they got a line just going out to the lake.
Yeah.
Yards, and they don't treat the water. And,
well, that's what we did.
Right. And I don't know what the laws on that are.
Huh.
Right. I'm told that people drink water from Lake Chelan that way.
I'm curious about, you said something, and part of what you said about when you're being, an antibiotic is being suggested, what to ask. I mean, I'm curious, I always feel like when I'm there and sick and they suggest an antibiotic, it's like, okay, what else, what's my choices, you know? So I don't, give me some advice on how to...
Is that necessary is the best question.
Mm-hmm.
Because... Unfortunately, the relationship between physicians and patients is a complex one. Many physicians gave people antibiotics unnecessarily for years because they thought the patients wanted that. It was a customer, you know. In other words, you're here for a cold. I assume you must want me to do something about it. Instead of... I've spent a lot of time explaining to people, good news, you have a viral infection and it's going to go away and you don't have to do anything. And the minority of people are relieved and say, oh, great. But most people say, what?
Give
you
me
mean
something.
You're not, yeah, you
yeah.
mean you're not going to do something about
yeah.
this?
Yeah.
So fortunately, the lay public is getting the idea that this practice of treating everything with antibiotics was unwise.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you stories about oh gee, I almost characterized a certain class of people. Well, let me just put it this way. I've seen yuppies arguing in the waiting room about whose kid has to take the more expensive antibiotic. Oh yeah, my kid's on this. It costs $185. Oh yeah, my kid's on this. It's like they're arguing over the Montessori school. So there was a sort of bizarre form of elitism about taking antibiotics, which of course the pharmaceutical companies loved, because every time an antibiotic becomes ineffective in treating a certain kind of infection, it's replaced by something that costs more, not by something that costs less.
Well, okay, so if I say, was that necessary, what are they going to say that's going to convince me?
They're going to say, yes,
yeah.
You have this particular problem which will respond to the antibiotic I'm giving you. If they say things like, well, you know, it's possible that you could get a secondary infection from this, and so therefore the antibiotic might help shorten the course of this illness. If they have to hedge like that, then the answer is you probably shouldn't take the medicine. If the answer is you've got strep, and strep is treatable with penicillin, and so that's what we're going to do, versus the, I don't know, maybe you have a sinus infection, maybe you know, we don't want you to get pneumonia, so let's put you on this medicine.
I had that a couple of years ago.
Right. And our practice of putting people on something so they didn't get pneumonia is the worst practice, because then when they got pneumonia,
yeah.
They got pneumonia with a germ that was resistant to the antibiotic you had
yeah.
just taken. Mm. Right. So anyway, we're learning on both sides of the fence.
Mm-hmm.
The doctors are learning and the
mm-hmm.
patients are learning.
Pharmaceuticals.
The pharmaceutical companies.
Maybe not.
They're going to own the world.
Business.
Which foods are the most laden with antibiotics?
Yeah.
Meat.
Just all kinds of meat or particular kinds?
Well, no, it's not the kind of meat that is, you know, there's nothing about the meat that makes an antibiotic prone. It's certain farming practices use antibiotics. And any type of factory farming where meat animals are raised in enclosures, those animals are very, very prone
yeah.
to infections. And so they try to eradicate that by treating not the sick ones, but all of them
yeah.
with antibiotics. So probably it's most famous in poultry, but it can be true of swine and beef.
Veal.
Oh, veal is terrible. Yeah, veal is like the worst.
How about eggs and dairy products?
Dairy products, I think antibiotics are a slight problem with dairy products. In my estimation, other things are a worse problem in dairy products, and that's that a lot of chemicals like herbicides and pesticides end up in the milk. And secondly, then the intentional introduction of growth hormone mm-hmm. to make dairy cattle produce more milk then gives you growth hormone, which for some reason we kind of thought, well, that's cool. That must be good, right? but
and
of course,
eggs too.
That is not. You know, maybe Grant can answer the question about eggs more. I'm not that familiar with. I don't think pesticides and herbicides end up in eggs.
I'm not really. Pesticides.
They do.
Yeah. They're passed on from generation to generation.
Right, but it's okay, Harry, because the amount of pesticides has been determined by the government to be a safe amount.
It's completely different from the body.
It's strictly regulated.
Yeah, well, that's I make a joke here, and I suppose I shouldn't because it isn't funny. We oftentimes decide what's safe when we don't really know. And so cigarette smoking, for example, was thought to be safe. And we couldn't have been wronger about that. And certainly a lot of the limits that we set on things in our food sources are based on, well, a lot of people ate this much of this stuff and they didn't die, so it must be safe. And they fail to take into account things we don't understand yet about how it accumulates and so forth.
Can you talk a little bit more about staph? Is that a virus now?
No, staphylococcus are a family of bacteria.
It's a bacteria, okay.
Yeah, and there are...
So it's everywhere all the time?
With our skin, we have staphylococcus on our skin. Most of them are a pretty harmless form of staphylococcus called staph epidermidis. And I don't know what they're doing there. They're just making a living, hanging out. I don't know that they provide us with a whole lot of benefit, but maybe they do. And then some of the staph on our skin are kind of staph called staph aureus. And those are the ones that when you scrape your knee and it ends up getting infected, it's because those guys that were living on your skin got inoculated under your skin when you scraped it or burned it or whatever.
Now, an infected wound, can it spread from one person to another?
Yes.
It can, because it's a bacteria.
Yes, but if you have a burn that's infected, and you touch somebody else whose skin is intact, then those germs don't go through their intact skin. Okay? So they shouldn't get an infection from being around your infected burn unless they have cuts or abraded skin or some portal for those germs to get in. The classic example of the right along the margins of my thumbnail are all these germs living under the cuticle there. And they don't get inside me and they don't cause any infection until I hit my thumb with something and then it inoculates a bunch of them underneath there. And then not only does it hurt from hitting it, then about 2 or 3 days later, it's all red and swollen and infected just because some of those normal guys living on my skin got inoculated underneath.
I was milking my cow once. I was late for work. I didn't bleach my hands afterwards. And I got a piece of sawdust in my eye. And evidently I must have got the staph from the cattle that morning.
Yeah, that's
through my fingernail or something. Yeah. When I kicked the wood chip out of my eye, two days later I had staph in my eye and I was about blind.
Right,
but wood chip. Impressed by how fast it cleared up.
With antibiotic?
Was that?
Or did you use antibiotic or did it clear up on it?
I believe I went to the eye and ear clinic in Wenatchee, and I'm sure they did.
Yeah, they put you on antibiotic.
The guys, the doctor said that if I would have waited any longer, it would have been past the recovery point.
Yeah, you can get
been in big trouble.
You get an ulcer in your cornea from staph, and then you can end up losing your cornea. Yeah, it is a big deal. But you did a good job there of describing this complex sequence of events that goes from our normal circumstances to causing an infection. It was because that piece of wood made, you know, enough of a breach in the conjunctiva of your eye that those germs could get in. Because clearly, those germs are around our eye all the time and don't cause infection. So it just has to be that little something that gets it going. A bit of fiberglass or wood or something. Has to let it in the door, so to speak.
So if I would have bleached my hands that morning,
and I would have washed them with soap and water.
Yeah.
And I would have picked that out, wiped that out with my finger. I probably wouldn't have got it that
way. Hard to know, because maybe the little scratch just let the staph that were already in your eyelids in there. Maybe the red herring here is milking the cow. Maybe it's the staph that were already waiting there. It's all hard to know.
Yeah.
But I still think that's a very good example of how the fine line between everything working out okay and getting infected, you know, it's often a very fine line.
What's this new fad of antibacterial everything? You'll see like plastics and...
Yeah, and think, right, that stuff's embedded in them so that they never harbor bacteria. That's a very bad trend in my estimation, because the FDA does not make the company disclose what they mean by antibacterial. Has it been irradiated? Is it impregnated with some kind of poison? The whole concept of antibacterial soap was very confusing to me, because soap is antibacterial.
Yeah. Just regular soap.
Soap kills germs, that's why we use it. So then all of a sudden there's antibacterial soap, and I'm thinking, is that a redundancy? Or
did they add something?
Yeah, they do.
Oh.
Yeah, they do, and that's, so then is that okay?
Do you need that?
I don't know. Some of you are old enough to remember that Physohex came out.
Right.
It was this great stuff that killed germs.
Yeah.
And so germs, you know, cause acne, so people use it on their face.
Yeah.
People use it everywhere.
Yeah.
And then they found out, well, this hexachlorophene, which is the chemical that kills the germs, turns out it's bad for you. Mm-hmm. So then they can only sell it by prescription. Well, how many of these other anti-biological agents are going to prove to be bad news? And not only are we introducing them into our households, but they end up everywhere.
Yeah.
End up everywhere.
It's very strange. I mean, you go to the stores now and... Even in the last year, every other product says antibacterial.
Right.
It's hard to find a soap that doesn't have it.
Yeah.
No.
Right, it is.
And sometimes there just aren't soaps that don't have it.
Right.
Buy the old-fashioned.
But many antibacterial soaps, well, like I said, soap is antibacterial, but many of these agents are good and safe and so forth, but we don't have any way of knowing what they are.
Or a lot of advertisers just taking advantage of the fact that it's already antibacterial, so they can put that on the label.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, but I think products beyond soap, you know, like durable goods that are impregnated somehow with something that...
Yeah, plastic things.
Yeah, and I wonder, what's that stuff?
What's in there?
Very
so what is normally an antibacterial soap? Is it like...
Well, there's a variety of different chemicals. Yeah, antibacterial soaps, to the best of my knowledge, don't have antibiotics in them. Now, what's the difference between an antibiotic and an antibacterial? And it's a difference in nomenclature. But that would be a truly bad thing if you were using penicillin to wash your hands with.
Right.
Yeah.
So is it more along the lines of, like, when you were talking about alcohol being something that, or you know what I mean, that something that kills, or that just
some right, because some products, some products use the word antiseptic on them.
Right.
Yeah.
And boy, I don't know. I'm not sure what the FDA. What qualifies as an antiseptic, an antibacterial, and an antibiotic.
So do you think there's going to be anybody concerned about, is there going to be any more legislation about how...
Oh, yes. Yeah, but that'll, you know, legislation always follows the technology
a
by
time.
A number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. Because there's always a powerful lobby.
Mm-hmm.
My advice is, when you cut yourself or burn yourself, or before you eat, is to wash your hands with soap and water. And I like the waterless hand cleansers that are alcohol. Bacteria will never develop a resistance to alcohol. It lyses their cell walls. There's no, they can't mutate some defense against that. It's like fire. Fire for sure kills things. And you know, so, and boiling.
Yeah.
You know, there's certain things that there won't be resistance to. Does that mean I'm out of time, Jerry? Giardia can be boiled, but the cis form of Giardia, you got to boil the water for 15 to 20 minutes.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, so filters are...
So, you know, you should...
15 to 20
back.
Minutes. Wait a minute.
I've heard just let it boil. I've also heard 5 minutes. Like,
you know, it's a long time.
That's terrible.
Yeah, boiling your water is an inefficient. It's an effective way of sterilizing it, but it's inefficient.
Uh-oh.
Three questions, three parts.
I thought I was going to say 3 minutes.
Why in the world would okay, what typically causes sore throat? Why in the world would the body's reaction to heal be to give you a sore throat of any place in the body? And that's completely related to it. And antiseptic mouthwash. Could you speak to that?
I sure will. The overwhelming majority of sore throats are caused by viral infections. Oh, wait. I recant.
It's on tape.
Yeah, I know. The tape probably just ended. If an infection is responsible for your sore throat, it's overwhelmingly likely that that infection is due to a virus. There's only a couple of kinds of bacteria that cause sore throat. The most famous, which killed millions of people throughout history, is diphtheria, which fortunately all of us have been immunized. The most common persistent bacterial form of infection that causes a sore throat is strep. And between the ages of about 5 and 15, strep is relatively common. It's not very common in small children, and it's quite uncommon in adults. So viral infections are the most common infectious cause of sore throats. Sore throats, of course, can be caused by environmental changes like exceedingly dry air, can be caused by allergies, which irritate the back of the throat, and so on. So environmental causes of sore throat is also common. Now, why does your body react by giving you a sore throat when it has this viral infection? Viruses have a predilection for certain target organs. Okay? In other words, the hantavirus, which kills people, directs most of its pathology at the lungs, causes people's lungs to fill up with fluid, and they die from respiratory distress. Okay, so why does that? What is it in that piece of genetic information that targets a specific organ, like the hepatitis virus targets your liver, and the sore throat virus targets your throat? I can't answer that, and I don't think anybody can. I don't think the answer to that is. What gives you a sore throat is it's infected with these viruses, and your immune system is going to try and eradicate that infection. And part of your immune system's response is inflammation. So you gave yourself a sore throat. The virus is just a causative agent of your own immune response.
A lot of the damage caused by what makes us sick is our own immune system. And the role of inflammation in things like getting heart attacks and things like that is becoming increasingly better known. And that's why we're trying to learn to modulate our own immune system. Now, what was the third part of the question? Antiseptic mouthwash is, of course, alcohol. And it kills germs, and it kills the little cells in the back of your throat, too.
Does it kill the alcohol kills good and bad cells, have you said to you before? So then
kills the good germs, kills the bad germs.
So is it a good practice?
I don't think it's a good practice. There are mouthwashes that aren't alcohol. Listerine is the classic alcohol machine.
And I would,
if you want to use a mouthwash for bad breath, then you want to buy the one that says, you know, there's no alcohol.
So just like,
because alcohol's bad for you.
Because
it causes throat cancer, esophagus cancer.
Listerine has alcohol.
You know what the last
Yeah, that's what Listerine is. It's alcohol.
The last time I was at my doctor, she said that she looked at my teeth and she said, looks like you take good care of your teeth. Gingivitis is starting to be connected to heart disease.
Yes, it is.
Gingivitis?
Yeah.
Floss.
Are you kidding me?
There's a, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And the reason for that isn't clear, but people who have gingivitis have heart attacks. And so they're trying to refine if the two are related, which apparently they are. In other words, it's not just like poor people with bad health habits have gingivitis, and therefore, ipso facto, they're poor people and have bad health habits, so they also have heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
It actually turns out that the two are probably related, and they're related to the bacteria that get in your bloodstream from your chronically infected gums.
Oh my
God. Listerine helps fight gingivitis.
Listerine kills germs, but remember, you've got germs in your mouth that are on the job, doing a good job. And so there's germs that live between your teeth and gums that are your friends too.
So by using
so if you floss, do you get rid of them?
No, you just rearrange them.
Okay.
By using Listerine,
it's like herding them.
could I then train my body not to produce as many of those things, and therefore make it have it cause?
I've never seen a long-term study on the use of Listerine. Their claim that it kills germs is true because it's alcohol. But it's also true that chronic exposure to alcohol is bad for you. It causes throat cancer, esophageal cancer.
But I gargle with mouthwash every day.
Okay, well, you might want to rethink that. Flossing is and brushing your teeth is far better for your mouth health than gargling.
Is that also true of drinking alcohol, like wine, beer?
Fortunately, the concentration of alcohol in beer is low enough.
Oh, boy, of course.
Beer, well,
gargle with beer.
Beer can go bad because the alcohol is not high enough to kill germs. And so, as you know from brewing, if you get contaminated stuff, your beer stinks because it won't kill those germs. Wine. Oftentimes that's true in wine too. So drinking those things, the concentration is low enough that's probably not true.
So drinking hard liquor though, besides the effects on your body at large, it actually causes cancer in alcoholics.
The risk of mouth, throat, and esophageal cancer is much higher in alcoholics. Jerry Goh, I bet we're out of time. So now we're talking off the record, so now you can really ask me which one.
I mean, how could Listerine be a cancer-causing agent?
Yeah, right.
Because we have hands off on alcohol in this country. Alcohol is a sacred cow. Alcohol is clearly bad for us and for our society, and we tolerate it. The reason we tolerate it is because we have decided to tolerate. But the cost of alcohol to society is, I've seen numbers like $150 billion a year. And
we just
talking about alcohol. So they could not say, you know, we can't say, the FDA is not going to make them say, don't use this product, it's bad for you, because we have decided to let alcohol be sold.
But why not? Why would it not have like a little disclaimer like tobacco?
I don't know. I haven't seen the bottle.
He doesn't use it.
But it's valuable as an antiseptic.
The claim is that kills germs, and it does. But the question is that good? And I'm saying, I don't know. I don't think so.
My dentist disagrees.
That's because my dentist told me that. They give us the...
They're
sponsored
though by the company.
They give them Listerine, or they give these things a scope.
Listerine. I don't get mouthwash. I just get floss.
Well, one of my hygienists wanted me to take the fluoride line because she thought that helped. But one of them thought Listerine was good for her. My doctor said no, just floss and brush.
Well, I don't want to pass myself off as an expert here. Hey, this is really out of my area of expertise.
Yeah.
But I hear the same thing. The flossing and brushing is the way to go.
That's what my doctor said.
What can you say about salt and how it affects viruses or bacteria and vinegar?
One of the things we talked about, the reason bacteria have been so successful evolutionarily is that they have this cell wall that lets them survive a hostile environment like salt and vinegar. So the concentration of salt or vinegar has to be high enough to lyse the cell wall. And that's, of course, why we started pickling food so they wouldn't go bad. We put them in acetic acid, which is what vinegar is, and that kills germs, A, and B, won't let them grow. Now, how strong does it have to be to do that? Just like we talked about with alcohol, how strong, beer isn't strong enough to kill germs. So how strong does that have to be? And I can't answer that. So, but that's the whole advantage of pickling.
But if you gargle with salt water,
yeah, which I frequently recommend.
For sore throat.
You mean you recommend frequently? Is it like we do it frequently? Or you recommend?
No, I frequently recommend it for sore throats. Yeah.
So is that just a soothing thing, or is that a?
It's both. It feels better.
It's healing, isn't it?
It does feel good.
And then the salt water removes the debris, which is the dead cells and germs that got killed in the war with your immune system. It carries them away. Hmm. My mom told me to do it,
Your mom didn't tell you Listerine.
Is there any health benefit of gargling salt water when you're not sick?
I don't think so.
So vinegar does the same thing as salt.
for food preservation or for what?
For bacteria.
I know people that take a tablespoon of vinegar.
Yeah.
It's
a question of amount. You have to make salt water really salty to kill bacteria. It has to be very strong because they're able to stand like 20 times their osmotic gradient. So I would say that the vinegar is a better way of killing bacteria than the salt.